might have been a subconscious trigger for a hypnotic suggestion, and that it might also have been the epicenter of whatever had spread out to become Area X. My briefing on the ecology of that place had had a similar blinkered focus. I had spent most of my time becoming familiar with the natural transitional ecosystems, with the flora and fauna and the cross-pollination I could expect to find. But I had also had an intense refresher on fungi and lichen that, in light of the words on the wall, now stood out in my mind as being the true purpose of all of that study. If the map had been meant solely to distract, then the ecology research had been meant, after all, to truly prepare me, unless I was being paranoid. But if I wasn't, it meant they knew about the tower, perhaps had always known about the tower. From there my suspicions grew. They had put us through grueling survival and weapons training, so grueling that most evenings we went right to sleep in our separate quarters. Even on those few occasions when we trained together, we were training apart. They took away our names in the second month, stripped them from us. The only names applied to things in Area X, and only in terms of their most general label. This, too, a kind of distraction from asking certain questions that could only be reached through knowing specific details. But the right specific details, not, for example, that there were 6 species of poisonous snakes in Area X. A reach, yes, but I was not in the mood to set aside even the most unlikely scenarios. By the time we were ready to cross the border, we knew everything. And we knew nothing. The psychologist wasn't there when we emerged, blinking into the sunlight, ripping off our masks, and breathing in the fresh air. We had been ready for almost any scenario, but not for the psychologist's absence. It left us adrift for a while, afloat in that ordinary day, the sky so brightly blue, the strand of trees casting long shadows. I took out my earplugs and found I couldn't hear the beating of the tower's heartbeat at all. How what we had seen below could coexist with the mundane was baffling. It was as if we had come up too fast from a deep sea dive, but it was the memories of the creatures we had seen that had given us the bends. We just kept searching the environs for the psychologist, certain she was hiding, and half hoping we would find her, because surely she had an explanation. It was, after a time, pathological to keep searching the same area around the tower, but for almost an hour, we could not find a way to stop. Finally, I could not deny the truth. "She's gone," I said.
"Maybe she's back at the base camp," the surveyor said.
"Would you agree that her absence is a sign of guilt?" I asked. The surveyor spat into the grass, regarded me closely.
"No, I would not. Maybe something happened to her. Maybe she needed to go back to the camp."
"You saw the footprints. You saw the body." She motioned with her rifle.
"Let's just get back to base camp."
I couldn't read her at all. I didn't know if she was turning on me or just cautious. Coming up above ground had emboldened her regardless, and I had preferred her uncertain. But back at base camp, some of her resolve crumbled again. The psychologist wasn't there. Not only wasn't she there, but she had taken half of our supplies and most of the guns, either that or buried them somewhere, so we knew the psychologist was still alive. You must understand how I felt then, how the surveyor must have felt. We were scientists, trained to observe natural phenomena and the results of human activity. We had not been trained to encounter what appeared to be the uncanny. In unusual situations, there can be a comfort in the presence of even someone you think might be your enemy. Now, we had come close to the edges of something unprecedented. And less than a week into our mission, we had lost not just the linguist at the border, but our anthropologist and our psychologist.
"Okay, I give up," the surveyor said, throwing down her rifle and sagging into a chair in front of the anthropologist's tent as I rummaged around inside of it. "I'm going to believe you for now. I'm going to believe you because I don't really have a choice, because I don't have any better theories. What should we do now?
There still weren't any clues in the anthropologist's tent. The horror of what had happened to her was still hitting me. To be coerced into your own death. If I was right, the psychologist was a murderer, much more so than whatever had killed the anthropologist. When I didn't answer the surveyor, she repeated herself with extra emphasis.
So what the hell are we going to do now?
Emerging from the tent, I said, we examine the samples I took, we develop the photographs, and go through them. Then tomorrow, we probably go back down into the tower. The surveyor gave a harsh laugh as she struggled to find words. Her face seemed to almost want to pull apart for a second, perhaps from the strain of fighting off the ghost of some hypnotic suggestion. Finally, she got it out.
No, I'm not going back down into that place. And it's a tunnel, not a tower.
What do you want to do instead? I asked. As if she'd broken through some barrier, the words now came faster, more determined.
We go back to the border and await extraction. We don't have the resources to continue. And even if you're right, the psychologist is out there right now plotting something, even if it's just what excuses to give us. And if she's not, if she's dead or injured because something attacked her, that's another reason to get the hell out.
She had lit a cigarette, one of the few we'd been given. She blew two long plumes of smoke out of her nose. I'm not ready to go back, I told her. Not yet. I wasn't near ready, despite what had happened.
You prefer this place. You really do, don't you?
The surveyor said. It wasn't really a question. A kind of pity or disgust infused her voice.
You think this is going to last much longer? Let me tell you. Even on military maneuvers designed to simulate negative outcomes, I've seen better odds.
Fear was driving her, even if she was right. I decided to steal my delaying tactics from the psychologist.
Let's just look at what we brought back, and then we can decide what to do. You can always head back to the border tomorrow.
She took another drag on the cigarette, digesting that. The border was still a 4-day hike away.
True enough, she said, relenting for a moment.
I didn't say what I was thinking, that it might not be that simple, that she might make it back across the border only in the abstract sense that my husband had, stripped of what made her unique, but I didn't want her to feel as if she had no way out. I spent the rest of the afternoon looking at samples under the microscope, on the makeshift table outside of my tent. The surveyor busied herself with developing the photographs in the tent that doubled as a darkroom. A frustrating process for anyone used to digital uploads. Then, while the photos were resting, she went back through the remnants of maps and documents the prior expedition had left at the base camp. My samples told a series of cryptic jokes with punchlines I didn't understand. The cells of the biomass that made up the words on the wall had an unusual structure, but they still fell within an acceptable range. Or those cells were doing a magnificent job of mimicking certain species of saprotrophic organisms. I made a mental note to take a sample of the wall from behind the words. I had no idea how deeply the filaments had taken root, or if there were nodes beneath and those filaments were only sentinels. The tissue sample from the hand-shaped creature resisted any interpretation, and that was strange, but told me nothing, by which I mean I found no cells in the sample, just a solid amber surface with air bubbles in it. At the time, I interpreted this as a contaminated sample or evidence that this organism decomposed quickly. Another thought came to me too late to test, that, having absorbed the organism's spores, I was causing a reaction in the sample. I didn't have the medical facilities to run the kinds of diagnostics that might have revealed any further changes to my body or mind since the encounter. Then there was the sample from the anthropologist's vial. I had left it for last for the obvious reasons. I had the surveyor take a section, put it on the slide, and write down what she saw through the microscope.
Why? She asked. Why did you need me to do this?
I hesitated. Hypothetically, there could be contamination. Such a hard face. Jaw tight.
Hypothetically, why would you be any more or less contaminated than me?
I shrugged. No particular reason. I was the first one to find the words on the wall, though. She looked at me as if I had spouted nonsense, laughed harshly.
We're in so much deeper than that. Do you really think those masks we wore are going to keep us safe from whatever's going on here?
She was wrong. I thought she was wrong, but I didn't correct her. People trivialize or simplify data for so many reasons. There was nothing else to be said. She went back to her work as I squinted through the microscope at the sample from whatever had killed the anthropologist. At first, I didn't know what I was looking at because it was so unexpected. It was brain tissue. And not just any brain tissue. The cells were remarkably human, with some irregularities. My thought at the time was that the sample had been corrupted, but if so, not by my presence. The surveyor's notes perfectly described what I saw, and when she looked at the sample again later, she confirmed its unchanged nature. I kept squinting through the microscope lens and raising my head and squinting again, as if I couldn't see the sample correctly. Then I settled down and stared at it until it became just a series of squiggles and circles. Was it really human? Was it pretending to be human? As I said, there were irregularities. And how had the anthropologist taken the sample? Just walked up to the thing with an ice cream scoop and asked, "Can I take a biopsy of your brain?" No. The sample had to come from the margins, from the exterior, which meant it couldn't be brain tissue, which meant it was definitely not human. I felt unmoored, drifting once again. About then, the surveyor strode over and threw the developed photographs down on my table. "Useless," she said. Every photograph of the words on the wall was a riot of luminous, out-of-focus color. Every photograph of anything other than the words had come out as pure darkness. The few in-between photos were also out of focus. I knew this was probably because of the slow, steady breathing of the walls, which might also have been giving off some kind of heat or other agent of distortion. A thought that made me realize I had not taken a sample of the walls. I had recognized the words were organisms. I had known the walls were too, but my brain had still registered walls as inert, part of a structure. Why sample them?
"I know," the surveyor said, misunderstanding my cursing. "Any luck with the samples?"
"No, no luck at all," I said, still staring at the photographs. "Anything in the maps or papers?"
The surveyor snorted. "Not a damn thing. Nothing except they all seemed fixated on the lighthouse, watching the lighthouse, going to the lighthouse, living in the goddamn lighthouse."
"So we have nothing." The surveyor ignored that, said,
"What do we do now?"
It was clear she hated asking the question. "Eat dinner," I said. "Take a little stroll along the perimeter to make sure the psychologist isn't hiding in the bushes. Think about what we're doing tomorrow."
"I'll tell you one thing we're not doing tomorrow. We're not going back into the tunnel."
"Tower." She glared at me. There was no point in arguing with her. At dusk, the familiar moaning came to us from across the salt marsh flats as we ate our dinner around the campfire. I hardly noticed it, intent on my meal. The food tasted so good, and I did not know why. I gobbled it up, had seconds, while the surveyor, baffled, just stared at me. We had little or nothing to say to each other. Talking would have meant planning, and nothing I wanted to plan would please her. The wind picked up, and it began to rain. I saw each drop fall as a perfect faceted liquid diamond, refracting light even in the gloom, and I could smell the sea and picture the roiling waves. The wind was like something alive. It entered every pore of me, and it, too, had a smell, carrying with it the earthiness of the marsh reeds. I had tried to ignore the change in the confined space of the tower, but my senses still seemed too acute, too sharp. I was adapting to it, but at times like this, I remembered that just a day ago, I had been someone else. We took turns standing watch. Loss of sleep seemed less foolhardy than letting the psychologist sneak up on us unannounced. She knew the location of every perimeter tripwire, and we had no time to disarm and reset them. I let the surveyor take the first watch as a gesture of good faith. In the middle of the night, the surveyor came in to wake me up for the second shift, but I was already awake because of the thunder. Grumpily, she headed off to bed. I doubt she trusted me. I just think she couldn't keep her eyes open a moment longer after the stresses of the day. The rain renewed its intensity. I didn't worry that we'd be blown away. These tents were army regulation and could withstand anything short of a hurricane. But if I was going to be awake anyway, I wanted to experience the storm. So I walked outside into the welter of the stinging water. The gusting pockets of wind. I already could hear the surveyor snoring in her tent. She probably had slept through much worse. The dull emergency lights glowed from the edges of the camp, making the tents into triangles of shadow. Even the darkness seemed more alive to me, surrounding me like something physical. I can't even say it was a sinister presence. I felt in that moment as if it were all a dream. The training, my former life, the world I had left behind. None of that mattered anymore. Only this place mattered, only this moment, and not because the psychologist had hypnotized me. In the grip of that powerful emotion, I stared out toward the coast, through the jagged, narrow spaces between the trees. There, a greater darkness gathered, the confluence of the night, the clouds, and the sea, somewhere beyond another border. Then, through that darkness, I saw it, a flicker of orange light, just a touch of illumination, too far up in the sky. This puzzled me, until I realized it must originate with the lighthouse. As I watched, the flicker moved to the left and up slightly before being snuffed out, then reappeared a few minutes later, much higher, then was snuffed out for good. I waited for the light to return, but it never did. For some reason, the longer the light stayed out, the more restless I became, as if in this strange place a light, any sort of light, was a sign of civilization. There had been a storm that final full day alone with my husband after he returned from the 11th expedition, a day that had the clarity of dream, of something strange yet familiar, familiar routine but strange calmness, even more than I had become accustomed to before he left. In those last weeks before the expedition, we had argued violently. I had shoved him up against a wall, thrown things at him, anything to break through the armor of resolve that I know now might have been thrust upon him by hypnotic suggestion. "If you go," I had told him, "you might not come back, and you can't be sure I'll be waiting for you if you do," which had made him laugh infuriatingly and say, "Oh, have you been waiting for me all this time? Have I arrived yet?" He was set in his course by then, and any obstruction was a source of rough humor for him, and that would have been entirely natural, hypnosis or not. It was entirely in keeping with his personality to become set on something and follow it, regardless of the consequences, to let an impulse become a compulsion, especially if he thought he was contributing to a cause greater than himself. It was one reason he had stayed in the Navy for a second tour. Our relationship had been thready for a while, in part because he was gregarious and I preferred solitude. This had once been a source of strength in our relationship, but no longer. Not only had I found him handsome, but I admired his confident, outgoing nature, his need to be around people. I recognized this as a healthy counterbalance to my personality. He had a good sense of humor, too, and when we first met at a crowded local park, he snuck past my reticence by pretending we were both detectives working a case and were there to watch a suspect, which led to making up facts about the lives of the busy hive of people buzzing around us, and then about each other. At first, I must have seemed mysterious to him, my guardedness, my need to be alone, even after he thought he'd gotten inside my defenses. Either I was a puzzle to be solved, or he just thought that once he got to know me better, he could still break through to some other place, some core where another person lived inside of me. During one of our fights, he admitted as much, tried to make his volunteering for the expedition a sign of how much I'd pushed him away, before taking it back later, ashamed. I told him point blank, so there would be no mistake. This person he wanted to know better did not exist. I was who I seemed to be from the outside. That would never change. Early in our relationship, I had told my husband about the swimming pool as we lay in bed, something we did a lot of back then. He had been captivated, possibly even thinking there were more interesting revelations to come. He had pushed aside the parts that spoke of an isolated childhood to focus entirely on the pool itself.
I would have sailed boats on it.
Captained by old Flopper, no doubt, I replied, and everything would have been happy and wonderful.
No, because I would have found you surly and willful and grim. Fairly grim.
I would have found you frivolous and wished really hard for the turtles to scuttle your boat.
If they did, I would just have rebuilt it even better and told everyone about the grim kid who talked to frogs.
I had never talked to the frogs. I despised anthropomorphizing animals. So, what has changed if we wouldn't have liked each other as kids? I asked.
Oh, I would have liked you despite that, he said, grinning. You would have fascinated me, and I would have followed you anywhere without hesitation.
So we fit back then, in our odd way. We clicked by being opposites and took pride in the idea that this made us strong. We reveled in this construct so much for so long that it was a wave that did not break until after we were married, and then it destroyed us over time in depressingly familiar ways. But none of this, the good or the bad, mattered when he returned from the expedition. I asked no questions, did not bring up any of our past arguments. I knew when I woke up beside him that morning after his return that our time together was already running out. I made him breakfast while outside the rain beat down, lightning cracking nearby. We sat at the kitchen table, which had a view through the sliding glass doors of the backyard, and had an excruciatingly polite conversation over eggs and bacon. He admired the gray shape of the new bird feeder I had put in, and the water feature that now rippled with raindrops. I asked him if he had gotten enough sleep and how he felt. I even asked again questions from the night before, like whether the journey back had been tough.
No, he said. Effortless,
flashing an imitation of his old infuriating smile. How long did it take? I asked.
No time at all.
I couldn't read his expression, but in its blankness I sensed something mournful, something left inside that wanted to communicate but couldn't. My husband had never been mournful or melancholy as long as I had known him, and this frightened me a little. He asked me how my research was going, and I told him about some of the new developments. At the time, I worked for a company devoted to the creation of natural products that broke down plastics and other non-biodegradable substances. It was boring. Before that, I had been out in the field taking advantage of various research grants. Before that, I had been a radical environmentalist, participating in protests and employed by a non-profit to call potential donors on the phone. And your work? I asked, tentative, not sure how much more circling I could do, ready at a moment's notice to dart away from the mystery.
Oh, you know,
he said, as if he'd only been away a few weeks, as if I were a colleague, not his lover, his wife.
Oh, you know, the same as always, nothing really new.
He drank deeply from his orange juice, really drank to savor it, so that for a minute or two nothing existed in the house but his enjoyment. Then he casually asked about other improvements around the house. After breakfast, we sat on the porch watching the sheets of rain, the puddles collecting in the herb garden. We read for a while, then went back inside and made love. It was a kind of repetitive, trance-like fucking, comfortable only because the weather cocooned us. If I had been pretending up until that point, I couldn't fool myself any longer that my husband was entirely present. Then it was lunch, and then television. I found a rerun of a two-man sailing race for him, and more banal talk. He asked about some of his friends, but I had no answers. I never saw them. They'd never really been my friends. I didn't cultivate friends. I had just inherited them from my husband. We tried to play a board game and laughed at some of the sillier questions. Then weird gaps in his knowledge became apparent, and we stopped, a kind of silence settling over us. He read the paper and caught up on his favorite magazines, watched the news, or perhaps he only pretended to do those things. When the rain stopped, I woke from a brief nap on the couch to find him gone from beside me. I tried not to panic when I checked every room and couldn't find him anywhere. I went outside and eventually found him around the side of the house. He was standing in front of the boat he had bought a few years back, which he could never fit in the garage. It was just a cruiser, about 20 feet long, but he loved it. As I came and curled my arm around his, he had a puzzled, almost forlorn look on his face, as if he could remember that the boat was important to him, but not why. He didn't acknowledge my presence, kept staring at the boat with a growing blank intensity. I could feel him trying to recall something important. I just didn't realize until much later that it had to do with me. That he could have told me something vital then, there, if he could only have recalled what. So we just stood there, and although I could feel the heat and weight of him beside me, the steady sound of his breathing, we were living apart. After a while, I couldn't take it, the sheer directionless anonymity of his distress, his silence. I led him back inside. He didn't stop me. He didn't protest. He didn't try to look back over his shoulder at the boat. I think that's when I made my decision. If he had only looked back, if he had just resisted me, even for a moment, it might have been different. At dinner, as he was finishing, they came for him in 4 or 5 unmarked cars and a surveillance van. They did not come in rough or shouting, with handcuffs and weapons on display. Instead, they approached him with respect, one might almost say fear, the kind of watchful gentleness you might display if about to handle an unexploded bomb. He went without protest, and I let them take this stranger from my house. I couldn't have stopped them, but I also didn't want to. The last few hours I had coexisted with him in a kind of rising panic, more and more convinced that whatever had happened to him in Area X had turned him into a shell, an automaton going through the motions, someone I had never known. With every atypical act or word, he was driving me further from the memory of the person I had known, and despite everything that had happened, preserving that idea of him was important. That is why I called the special number he had left me for emergencies. I didn't know what to do with him, couldn't coexist with him any longer in this altered state. Seeing him leave, I felt mostly a sense of relief, to be honest, not guilt at betrayal. What else could I have done? As I have said, I visited him in the observation facility right up until the end. Even under hypnosis in those taped interviews, he had nothing new to say, really, unless it was kept from me. I remember mostly the repetitious sadness in his words. I'm walking forever on the path from the border to base camp. It is taking a long time, and I know it will take even longer to get back. There is no one with me. I am all by myself. The trees are not trees, the birds are not birds, and I am not me, but just something that has been walking for a very long time. This was really the only thing I discovered in him after his return, a deep and unending solitude, as if he had been granted a gift that he didn't know what to do with, a gift that was poison to him and eventually killed him. But would it have killed me? That was the question that crept into my mind, even as I stared into his eyes those last few times, willing myself to know his thoughts and failing. As I labored at my increasingly repetitive job in a sterile lab, I kept thinking about Area X and how I would never know what it was like without going there. No one could really tell me, and no account could possibly be a substitute. So several months after my husband died, I volunteered for an Area X expedition. A spouse of a former expedition member had never signed up before. I think they accepted me in part because they wanted to see if that connection might make a difference. I think they accepted me as an experiment. But then again, maybe from the start they expected me to sign up. By morning, it had stopped raining and the sky was a searing blue, almost devoid of clouds. Only the pine needles strewn across the tops of our tents and the dirty puddles and fallen tree limbs on the ground told of the storm the night before. The brightness infecting my senses had spread to my chest. I can describe it no other way. Internally, there was a brightness in me, a kind of prickling energy and anticipation that pushed hard against my lack of sleep. Was this part of the change? But even so, it didn't matter. I had no way to combat what might be happening to me. I also had a decision to make, finding myself torn between the lighthouse and the tower. Some part of the brightness wanted to return to the darkness at once, and the logic of this related to nerve, or lack of it. To plunge right back into the tower, without thought, without planning, would be an act of faith, of sheer resolve, or recklessness with nothing else behind it. But now I also knew that someone had been in the lighthouse the night before. If the psychologist had sought refuge there, I could track her down. Then I might gain more insight into the tower before exploring it further. This seemed of increasing importance, more so than the night before, because the number of unknowns the tower represented had multiplied tenfold. So by the time I talked to the surveyor, I had decided on the lighthouse. The morning had the scent and feel of a fresh start, but it was not to be. If the surveyor had wanted no part of a return to the tower, then she equally had no interest in the lighthouse. "You don't want to find out if the psychologist is there?" The surveyor gave me a look as if I had said something idiotic. "Hold up in a high position, with clear lines of sight in every direction, in a place they've told us has a weapons cache. I'll take my chances here. If you were smart, you'd do the same. You might find out that you don't like a bullet hole in the head. Besides, she might be somewhere else." Her stubbornness tore at me. I didn't want to split up. For purely practical reasons, it was true we had been told prior expeditions had stored weapons at the lighthouse, and because I believed it more likely that the surveyor would try to go home without me there. "It's the lighthouse or the tower," I said, trying to sidestep the issue. "And it would be better for us if we found the psychologist before we went back down into the tower. She saw whatever killed the anthropologist. She knows more than she's told us." The unspoken thought that perhaps if a day passed or two, whatever lived in the tower, slowly making words on the wall, would have disappeared or gotten so far ahead of us we would never catch up. But that brought to mind a disturbing image of the tower as endless, with infinite levels descending into the earth. The surveyor folded her arms. "You really don't get it, do you? This mission is over." Was she afraid? Did she just not like me enough to say yes? Whatever the reason, her opposition angered me, as did the smug look on her face. In the moment, I did something I regret now. I said, "There's no reward in the risk of going back to the tower right now." I thought I had been subtle in my intonation of one of the psychologist's hypnotic cues, but a shudder passed over the surveyor's face, a kind of temporary disorientation. When it cleared, the look that remained told me she understood what I had tried to do. It wasn't even a look of surprise, more that in her mind I had confirmed an impression of me that had been slowly forming, but was now set. Now, too, I had learned that hypnotic cues only worked for the psychologist.
"You'd do anything, wouldn't you, to get your way?" the surveyor said.
But the fact was, she held the rifle. What weapon did I really have? And I told myself it was because I didn't want the anthropologist's death to be meaningless that I had suggested this course of action. When I did not reply, she sighed, then said, with weariness in her voice,
"You know, I finally figured it out while I was developing those useless photographs. What bothered me the most, it's not the thing in the tunnel or the way you conduct yourself or anything the psychologist did. It's this rifle I'm holding, this damn rifle.
I stripped it down to clean it and found it was made of 30-year-old parts cobbled together. Nothing we brought with us is from the present. Not our clothes, not our shoes. It's all old junk, restored crap. We've been living in the past this whole time, in some sort of reenactment. And why? She made a derisive sound. You don't even know why. It was as much as she'd ever said to me at one time. I wanted to say that this information registered as little more than the mildest of surprises in the hierarchy of what we had thus far discovered. But I didn't. All I had left was to be succinct. Will you remain here until I return? I asked. This was now the essential question, and I didn't like the speed of her reply or its tone.
Whatever you want.
Don't say anything you can't back up, I said. I had long ago stopped believing in promises. Biological imperatives, yes. Environmental factors, yes. Promises, no.
Fuck off, she said.
So that's how we left it. Her leaning back in that rickety chair, holding her assault rifle, as I went off to discover the source of the light I had seen the night before. I had with me a knapsack full of food and water, along with two of the guns, equipment to take samples, and one of the microscopes. Somehow I felt safer taking a microscope with me, some part of me too, no matter how hard I tried to convince the surveyor to come with me, welcomed the chance to explore alone, to not be dependent on or worried about anyone else. I looked back a couple of times before the trail twisted away, and the surveyor was still sitting there, staring at me like a distorted reflection of who I'd been just days before. 3. Immolation. Now a strange mood took hold of me as I walked silent and alone through the last of the pines and the cypress knees that seemed to float in the black water, the gray moss that coated everything. It was as if I traveled through the landscape with the sound of an expressive and intense aria playing in my ears. Everything was imbued with emotion, awash in it, and I was no longer a biologist, but somehow the crest of a wave building and building, but never crashing to shore. I saw with such new eyes the subtleties of the transition to the marsh, the salt flats, as the trail became a raised berm, dull, algae-choked lakes spread out to the right, and a canal flanked it to the left. Rough channels of water meandered out in a maze through a forest of reeds on the canal side, and islands, oases of wind-contorted trees, appeared in the distance like sudden revelations. The stooped and blackened appearance of these trees was shocking against the vast and shimmering gold-brown of the reeds. The strange quality of the light upon this habitat, the stillness of it all, the sense of waiting, brought me halfway to a kind of ecstasy. Beyond, the lighthouse stood, and before that, I knew, the remains of a village, also marked on the map. But in front of me was the trail, strewn at times with oddly tortured-looking pieces of heavy white driftwood, flung far inland from past hurricanes. Tiny red grasshoppers inhabited the long grass in legions, with only a few frogs present to feast on them, and flattened grass tunnels marked where the huge reptiles had, after bathing in the sun, slid back into the water. Above, raptors searched the ground below for prey, circling as if in geometric patterns, so controlled was their flight. In that cocoon of timelessness, with the lighthouse seeming to remain distant no matter how long I walked, I had more time to think about the tower and our expedition. I felt that I had abdicated my responsibility to that point, which was to consider those elements found inside of the tower as part of a vast biological entity that might or might not be terrestrial. But contemplating the sheer enormity of that idea on a macro level would have broken my mood like an avalanche crashing into my body. So, what did I know? What were the specific details? An organism was writing living words along the interior walls of the tower and may have been doing so for a very long time, Whole ecosystems have been born and now flourished among the words, dependent on them before dying off as the words faded. But this was a side effect of creating the right conditions, a viable habitat. It was important only in that the adaptations of the creatures living in the words could tell me something about the tower. For example, the spores I had inhaled, which pointed to a truthful seeing. I was brought up short by this idea. The wind lashed marsh reeds, a wide, blurred ripple all around me. I had assumed the psychologist had hypnotized me into seeing the tower as a physical construction, not a biological entity, and that an effect of the spores had made me resistant to this hypnotic suggestion. But what if the process had been more complex? What if, by whatever means, the tower emanated an effect too, one that constituted a kind of defensive mimicry, and the spores had made me immune to that illusion? Telescoping out from this context, I had several questions and few answers. What role did the crawler serve? I had decided it was important to assign a name to the maker of words. What was the purpose of the physical recitation of the words? Did the actual words matter, or would any words do? Where had the words come from? What was the interplay between the words and the tower creature? Put another way, were the words a form of symbiotic or parasitic communication between the crawler and the tower? Either the crawler was an emissary of the tower, or had originally existed independent from it and come into its orbit later. But without the damned missing sample of the tower wall, I couldn't really begin to guess. Which brought me back to the words. Where lies the strangling fruit that came from the hand of the sinner? Wasps and birds and other nest builders often used some core, irreplaceable substance or material to create their structures, but would also incorporate whatever they could find in their immediate environment. This might explain the seemingly random nature of the words. It was just building material, and perhaps this explained why our superiors had forbidden high-tech being brought into Area X, because they knew it could be used in unknown and powerful ways by whatever occupied this place. Several new ideas detonated inside me as I watched a marsh hawk dive into the reeds and come up with a rabbit struggling in its talons. First, that the words, the line of them, their physicality, were absolutely essential to the well-being of either the tower or the crawler, or both. I had seen the faint skeletons of so many past lines of writing that one might assume some biological imperative for the crawler's work. This process might feed into the reproductive cycle of the tower or the crawler. Perhaps the crawler depended upon it, and it had some subsidiary benefit to the tower, or vice versa. Perhaps words didn't matter because it was a process of fertilization, only completed when the entire left-hand wall of the tower had a line of words running along its length. Despite my attempt to sustain the aria in my head, I experienced a jarring return to reality as I worked through these possibilities. Suddenly, I was just a person trudging across a natural landscape of a type I had seen before. There were too many variables, not enough data, and I was making some base assumptions that might not be true. For one thing, in all of this, I assumed that neither crawler nor tower was intelligent, in the sense of possessing free will. My procreation theory could still apply in such a widening context, but there were other possibilities. The role of ritual, for example, in certain cultures and societies. How I longed for access to the anthropologist's mind now. Even though in studying social insects, I had gained some insight into the same areas of scientific endeavor. And if not ritual, I was back to the purposes of communication, this time in a conscious sense, not a biological one. What could the words on the wall communicate to the tower? I had to assume, or thought I did, that the crawler didn't just live in the tower. It went far afield to gather the words, and it had to assimilate them, even if it didn't understand them, before it came back to the tower. The crawler had to, in a sense, memorize them, which was a form of absorption. The strings of sentences on the tower's walls could be evidence brought back by the crawler to be analyzed by the tower. But there is a limit to thinking about even a small piece of something monumental. You still see the shadow of the whole rearing up behind you, and you become lost in your thoughts, in part from the panic of realizing the size of that imagined Leviathan. I had to leave it there, compartmentalized, until I could write it all down, and seeing it on the page, begin to divine the true meaning. And now the lighthouse had finally gotten larger on the horizon. This presence weighed on me as I realized that the surveyor had been correct about at least one thing. Anyone within the lighthouse would see me coming for miles. Then, too, that other effect of the spores, the brightness in my chest, continued to sculpt me as I walked, and by the time I reached the deserted village that told me I was halfway to the lighthouse, I believed I could have run a marathon. I did not trust that feeling. I felt in so many ways that I was being lied to. Having seen the preternatural calm of the members of the 11th Expedition, I had often thought during our training of the benign reporting from the first expedition. Area X, before the ill-defined event that locked it behind the border 30 years ago and made it subject to so many inexplicable occurrences, had been part of a wilderness that lay adjacent to a military base. People had still lived there, on what amounted to a wildlife refuge, but not many, and they tended to be the tight-lipped descendants of fisher folk. Their disappearance might have seemed to some a simple intensifying of the process begun generations before. When Area X first appeared, there was a vagueness and confusion, and it is still true that out in the world not many people know that it exists. The government's version of events emphasized a localized environmental catastrophe stemming from experimental military research. This story leaked into the public sphere over a period of several months, so that, like the proverbial frog in a hot pot, people found the news entering their consciousness gradually as part of the general daily dose of media oversaturation about ongoing ecological devastation. Within a year or two, it had become the province of conspiracy theorists and other fringe elements. By the time I volunteered and was given the security clearance to have a firm picture of the truth, the idea of an Area X lingered in many people's minds like a dark fairy tale, something they did not want to think about too closely, if they thought about it at all. We had so many other problems. During training, we were told that the first expedition went in 2 years after the event, after scientists found a way to breach the border. It was the first expedition that set up the base camp perimeter and provided a rough map of Area X, confirming many of the landmarks. They discovered a pristine wilderness devoid of any human life. They found what some might call a preternatural silence. I felt as if I were both freer than ever before and more constrained, one member of the expedition said. I felt as if I could do something as long as I did not mind being watched. Others mentioned feelings of euphoria and extremes of sexual desire, for which there was no explanation and which, ultimately, their superiors found unimportant. If one could spot anomalies in their reports, these anomalies lay at the fringes. For one thing, we never saw their journals. Instead, they offered up their accounts in long recorded interviews. This, to me, hinted at some avoidance of their direct experience, although at the time I also thought perhaps I was being paranoid in a non-clinical sense. Some of them offered descriptions of the abandoned village that seemed inconsistent to me. The warping and level of ruination depicted a place abandoned for much longer than a few years. But if someone had caught this strangeness earlier, any such observation had been stricken from the record. I am convinced now that I and the rest of the expedition were given access to these records for the simple reason that, for certain kinds of classified information, it did not matter what we knew or didn't know. There was only one logical conclusion. Experience told our superiors that few, if any of us, would be coming back. The deserted village had so sunk into the natural landscape of the coast that I did not see it until I was upon it. The trail dipped into a depression of sorts, and there lay the village, fringed by more stunted trees. Only a few roofs remained on the 12 or 13 houses, and the trail through had crumbled into porous rubble. Some outer walls still stood, dark rotting wood splotched with lichen. But for the most part these walls had fallen away and left me with a peculiar glimpse of the interiors, the remains of chairs and tables, a child's toys, rotted clothing, ceiling beams brought to earth, covered in moss and vines. There was a sharp smell of chemicals in that place, and more than one dead animal decomposing into the mulch. Some of the houses had, over time, slid into the canal to the left and looked in their skeletal remains like creatures struggling to leave the water. It all seemed like something that had happened a century ago, and what was left was just vague recollections of the event. But in what had been kitchens or living rooms or bedrooms, I also saw a few peculiar eruptions of moss or lichen, rising 4 or 5 feet tall, misshapen, the vegetative matter forming an approximation of limbs and heads and torsos, as if there had been runoff from the material, too heavy for gravity, that had congregated at the foot of these objects. Or perhaps I imagined this effect. One particular tableau struck me in an almost emotional way. 4 such eruptions, 1 standing and 3 decomposed to the point of sitting, in what once must have been a living room with a coffee table and a couch, all facing some point at the far end of the room where lay only the crumbling, soft brick remains of a fireplace and chimney. The smell of lime and mint unexpectedly arose, cutting through the must, the loam. I did not want to speculate on that tableau, its meaning, or what element of the past it represented. No sense of peace emanated from that place, only a feeling of something left unresolved or still in progress. I wanted to move on, but first I took samples. I had a need to document what I had found, and a photograph didn't seem sufficient, given how the others had turned out. I cut a piece of the moss from the forehead of one of the eruptions. I took splinters of the wood. I even scraped the flesh of the dead animals, a stricken fox, curled up and dry, along with a kind of rat that must have died only a day or two before. It was just after I had left the village that a peculiar thing happened. I was startled to see a sudden double line coming down the canal toward me, cutting through the water. My binoculars were no use, as the water was opaque from the glare of the sun. Otters? Fish? Something else? I pulled out my gun. Then the dolphins breached, and it was almost as vivid a dislocation as that first descent into the tower. I knew that dolphins here sometimes ventured in from the sea, had adapted to the fresh water, but when the mind expects a certain range of possibilities, any explanation that falls outside of that experience can surprise. Then something more wrenching occurred. As they slid by, the nearest one rolled slightly to the side, and it stared at me with an eye that did not, in that brief flash, resemble a dolphin eye to me. It was painfully human, almost familiar. In an instant that glimpse was gone, and they had submerged again, and I had no way to verify what I had seen. I stood there, watched those twinned lines disappear up the canal back toward the deserted village. I had the unsettling thought that the natural world around me had become a kind of camouflage. A little shaken, I continued toward the lighthouse, which now loomed larger, almost heavy, its black and white stripes topped with red, making it somehow authoritarian. I would have no further shelter before I reached my destination. I would stand out to whoever or whatever watched from that vantage as something unnatural in that landscape, something that was foreign, perhaps even a threat. It was almost noon by the time I reached the lighthouse. I had been careful to drink water and have a snack on my journey, but I still arrived weary. Perhaps the lack of sleep had caught up with me. But then, too, the last 300 yards to reach the lighthouse were tension-filled, as I kept remembering the surveyor's warning. I had a gun out, held down by my side, for all the good it would do against a high-powered rifle. I kept looking at the little window halfway up its swirled black-and-white surface, and then to the large panoramic window at the top, alert for any movement. The lighthouse was positioned just before a natural crest of the dunes that resembled a curled wave facing the ocean. The beach spread out beyond. Up close, it gave the strong appearance of having been converted into a fortress, a fact conveniently left out of our training. This only confirmed the impression I had formed from farther out, because although the grass was still long, no trees at all grew along the trail for about a quarter mile out. I had found only old stumps. When within an eighth mile, I had taken a look with my binoculars and noticed an approximately 10-foot circular wall rising from the landward side of the lighthouse that had clearly not been part of the original construction. On the seaward side, another wall, an even stouter-looking fortification, high on the crumbling dune, topped with broken glass, and as I drew near, I could see crenellations that created lines of sight for rifles. It was all in danger of falling down the slope onto the beach below. But for it not to have done so already, whoever had built it must have dug its foundations deep. It appeared that some past defenders of the lighthouse had been at war with the sea. I did not like this wall because it provided evidence of a very specific kind of insanity. At some point, too, someone had taken the time and effort to rappel down the sides of the lighthouse and attach jagged shards of glass with some strong glue or other adhesive. These glass daggers started about one-third of the way up and continued to the penultimate level just below the glass-enclosed beacon. At that point, a kind of metal collar extended out a good 2 or 3 feet, and this defensive element had been enhanced with rusty barbed wire. Someone had tried very hard to keep others out. I thought of the crawler and the words on the wall. I thought of the fixation with the lighthouse in the fragments of notes left by the last expedition. But despite these discordant elements, I was glad to reach the shadow of that cool, dank wall around the landward side of the lighthouse. From that angle, no one could shoot at me from the top, or the window in the middle. I had passed through the first gauntlet. If the psychologist was inside, she had decided against violence for now. The defensive wall on the landward side had reached a level of disrepair that reflected years of neglect. A large, irregular hole led to the lighthouse's front door. That door had exploded inward, and only fragments of wood clung to the rusted hinges. A purple flowering vine had colonized the lighthouse wall and curled itself around the remains of the door on its left side. There was comfort in that, for whatever had happened with such violence must have occurred long ago. The darkness beyond, however, made me wary. I knew from the floor plan I had seen during training that this bottom level of the lighthouse had 3 outer rooms, with the stairs leading to the top somewhere to the left, and that to the right the rooms opened up into a back area with at least one more larger space, plenty of places for someone to hide. I picked up a stone and half threw, half rolled it onto the floor beyond those crushed double doors. It clacked and spun across the tile and disappeared from view. I heard no other sound, no movement, no suggestion of breathing beyond my own. Gun still drawn, I entered as quietly as I was able, sliding with my shoulder along the left-hand wall, searching for the entry point to the stairs leading up. The outer rooms at the base of the lighthouse were empty. The sound of the wind was muffled, the walls thick, and only 2 windows toward the front brought any light inside. I had to use my flashlight. As my eyes adjusted, the sense of devastation, of loneliness, grew and grew. The purple flowering vine ended just inside, unable to thrive in the darkness. There were no chairs. tiles on the floor were covered with dirt and debris. No personal effects remained in those outer rooms. In the middle of a wide, open space, I found the stairs. No one stood on those steps to watch me, but I had the impression someone could have been there a moment before. I thought about climbing to the top first rather than exploring the back rooms, but then decided